Hello there. I'm Laura Lee, and welcome to The Laura Lee Show. Stephen Mailer joins us just back from Egypt, where he's had some extraordinary adventures and pulling together some data that would demonstrate that, yes, indeed, much of those most ancient pyramids are about 10,000 years old. He suspects because many of them are built over waterways that were fed by a river that was only in place 10,000 or so years ago. The current Nile just isn't where these waterways are going. He joins us from Colorado. Hi, Stephen. Thanks for being here tonight.
Hi, Laura. It's great to be on with you again.
You know, we're stunned by the evidence that the Sphinx may be much, much older due to that water erosion, and now you've got more water evidence for a much older Egypt, a pre-Egypt, a pre-what we know of as the Egyptian civilization. You call it the Kemetians.
Yes.
Tell us a bit of background.
Well, this has actually been a long journey for me. I've been studying the subject well over 30 years, and I had come at it from the academic Egyptological background, but somewhere along the line, it just seemed that they were not explaining totally what was going on there. And a great change for me occurred in the mid-70s when I discovered the book, Peter Tompkins' Secrets of the Great Pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
It just got me very interested in investigating non-Western Egyptological sources of information about this ancient civilization. And things led to my getting involved with the Rosicrucian Order in Amarc and San Jose, California, investigating the so-called metaphysical mystery school tradition. And that led me along the way to connecting with a gentleman who has become my teacher, who is an indigenous master bringing out the ancient wisdom teachings from Egypt. Now, this is something that is new because we've been hearing about indigenous teachers coming out, Native American teachers, Mayan teacher like Hunbat's men, Aboriginal teachers, but no one has ever spoken before of an indigenous tradition still living in Egypt.
Hmm.
About 1990, I investigated a book by a woman named Murray Hope, who has written many books on witchcraft and Wiccan tradition and about Egypt. She wrote a book called Ancient Egypt, the Sirius Connection in 1990, where she was following up on the work with someone you haven't interviewed, Robert Temple, in the Sirius Mystery, saying how the ancient Egyptians were very obsessed with the star system Sirius. In that book, she mentioned connecting with a living tradition, a tradition which we call a brotherhood, which has no gender reference, that still exists in Egypt, that was not converted to Islam, that was not converted to Coptic Christianity, that held the old ways, the old traditions. She named these people the Ammonites, the Ammonite Foundation. I have since learned that they have many different names, and this is really not their name. But that really turned the key for me, and I wanted to go and find this tradition that was non-Western, non-Egyptological, non-academic, to have sources about this ancient information. We had a very interesting meeting in March of 1992. When I was on your show 2 years ago, we talked about Dr. J.O. Kinnaman, and I am the director of research of the Kinnaman Foundation. Mm-hmm. We had a meeting in 92 with Dr. A.J. McDonald, who's the executive director and president of the Kinnaman Foundation, and with a gentleman named Dr. Albert Doss. Dr. Doss is a man now in his late 80s. He's a retired psychiatrist. He also is a native-born Egyptian, coming from a very wealthy family, and he's also a very high-ranking Rosicrucian.
Hmm.
We mentioned, I was with my research partner, a gentleman named Bob Vodder, who I will be talking about also a lot tonight. We were talking about our investigation of a tradition known as Thrice Greatest Hermes. Hermes Trismegistus in the Greek term, and how it was our conclusions that was Thrice Greatest Hermes represented three phases, three stages of a so-called brotherhood, a tradition that came out of the temples of ancient Egypt. Dr. Doss nodded in agreement and said, yes, but there is a fourth Hermes.
Hmm.
So we took that as a confirmation that there still was a living tradition in Egypt. I was determined definitely to get to Egypt by a series of miraculous events. I wound up in Egypt in November of 1992, and I met Abdel Hakim Aouyan, who is the master of the tradition, who keeps is a wisdom keeper, and we have been working together since. So what we're going to discuss tonight is the last 2 years I have taken research trips to Egypt in 1997, 1998, and Hakim has taken me to places where very few people go to find the source of this ancient civilization, which we do call Kemet. And we can explain, if you'd like me to, where that word really comes from, where the term comes.
There's a magazine about ancient Egypt
right.
called KMT,
exactly.
Kemet. And this was the old word that the Egyptians themselves used for the land of Egypt.
Exactly.
What's the root of that? Where does
okay.
that word come from?
As you said, KMT, because we know in the Egyptian script, the ancient language, they didn't have vowels, just had consonants. So it comes out as KMT. We put in the vowels. We adopt a spelling, Kemet, K-H-E-M-I-T. It's been spelled many different ways. But how the word comes about is, the word for the country today is Egypt. That is not the word that was before. Egypt comes from a Greek word, Egyptos, which is based on a contraction, Hegiptos, which basically comes from the ancient term, Het-Ka-Pta. Now, where that comes from, there is a village now in Egypt called Mitra'ena, which to the ancient Egyptians, the Greeks called it Memphis. Now, you may have visited there. A lot of people who go to Egypt visit the site. The ancient term was Menefer, which meant the generation of harmony, a beautiful term. But interesting, the key to the answer is Het Ka Pta means the place of the Ka. Het means place. Ka is a term that's been translated many different ways by the Egyptologists. We accept the master's translation. It's the physical projection of the soul. It's not the body, which was Chat or Chet, the ancients, with a T, the feminine ending, but it's like the personality, that which attaches itself to the body. And Ptah, well, that's another word we could spend a lot of time talking about, but for enough here to say it was one of the creator gods, one of the patron deities of the ancient people. So what the term is actually saying is the place of the personality of Ta. That only referred to one site, one area, which the Greeks called Memphis. It wasn't the whole country. The whole civilization was Kemet. Kemet, which meant the black land. The land of the alluvial soil deposited by the Nile, where you could grow, where you could live. That was the civilization.
Mm-hmm.
So the term Kemet is really what this country was. The people were Kemetian. They spoke the Kemetic language or the Kemetian language. And so what we are teaching under the aegis of our teacher, Abdel Hakim, is Kemetology, not Egyptology, which we feel is outdated, antiquated, and based on a Greco-Roman Judeo-Christian substruct, which is incorrect, which is not giving, if no one has ever listened to what these wisdom teachers have been trying to teach, just like, unfortunately, a lot of anthropologists didn't listen well enough to Native American teachers who were trying to teach their own tribal history. We now are listening. Now a lot of people are listening to indigenous teachers. Well, this indigenous master is coming forth and saying the civilization of Kemet goes back much, much further than the academic Egyptologist saying. It does not start with the so-called dynastic period around 3100 B.C., where they say this civilization suddenly flowered into, and all of a sudden they were building pyramids and all this and all that.
Where Zero to 60 in 100 years, right?
He puts a date. He puts a dense, you know, to them, as a true indigenous teacher, he says there was no beginning, just like there is no end. He doesn't support this concept of Zep Tepe that has been popularized by Robert Bouval and Graham Hancock and John West. There was no first time. But he's saying the current cycle of the Kemetian civilization started over 60,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So
well, the Australian Aborigines can trace their continuous lineage back 150,000 years
that's
now,
right.
So 60 doesn't sound so long. So Hakim would be then a member of that brotherhood then.
Absolutely.
This is the brotherhood that has kept alive the indigenous wisdom.
And they meet in silent. They do not make themselves known because it's a Muslim country. You know, they could be persecuted for that. He is well known. He is an elder of his village. He lives in the village of Nazlet Esaman, which is a village right on the Giza Plateau.
Mm-hmm.
So those people have grown up all their lives with the energy of the pyramids and Sphinx right in their backyard. They have passed from one generation to another these teachings. He was selected by his family, by his mother actually, and his aunt, because it's a female lineage thing, which is very interesting.
Oh.
He teaches the same thing that I was teaching 20 years ago when I did a master's degree at San Jose State University about the matrilineality, the matriarchy that ancient Egypt was. He teaches exactly the same. The lineage goes from mothers. But he was selected to be the one to carry the wisdom teachings. He comes from, his last name is Awiyan. He comes from what's called the Awiyane tribe, which means the eyes of Egypt. They're the watchers, the observers. Mm-hmm. They have very distinctive eyes, these wonderful green eyes, mm-hmm. which a lot of Egyptian people only have brown eyes.
Now, I've heard of a Hakim as a tour guide for Egypt, just exactly. like we've heard of Muhammad as a tour guide. They're very popular. Is right. this the same Hakim?
Yes, it is. Interestingly, this is how he is known. And I'm sure many of your listeners, many people who have gone to Egypt, will know this name, Hakim. He is very well known as a tour guide and Egyptologist. He has been a tour guide for over 40 years. Actually, it's going on 50 years now. He was used by many famous people like John Anthony West, Barbara Hand Clow, Nikki Scully, as their tour guide. For various reasons, these people are not using him anymore, but he was well known as the tour guide.
Would he have time to go and get all of those degrees?
Yes. Yes, he's an amazing man because he is also well trained in the Western tradition. He has degrees in Egyptology and archaeology. He actually did graduate work at Leiden University. And I refer to him as Dr. Abdel Hakim. That was a matter of respect. He does not formally have a PhD, but he's well trained in the Western tradition, so he understands. But now he has stepped forward as the indigenous teacher.
Now, many indigenous teachers believe that now is the time for some of their closely held wisdom to come out, that this is the time, and I suspect because you are now releasing some of this, that he also believes this is the time.
Absolutely.
We'll learn more about that from Stephen Mailer of the Kinnaman Foundation, who joins us to reveal some closely held wisdom tradition about how old the land of Kemet is, now known as Egypt, and the evidence for it. You're listening to The Laura Lee Show. I'm Laura Lee. Laura Lee here on The Laura Lee Show as we continue with Stephen Mailer. He's saying that ancient Egypt knew itself as Kemet. These people were Kemetians. Some of them in this indigenous lineage are still living and keeping that wisdom alive and want it to be known. Imagine, Stephen, a 60,000-year civilization. The past 10,000 years would be a small portion, one-sixth of that time. The Egyptians themselves told the Greeks that there were two previous civilizations before them. So this is all fitting in with a lot of, and making a lot of sense. It's fitting in with what you would suspect there. Tell me more.
Yes, well, it's an interesting way, the way Hakim does his teaching. When he takes you in the field, and he believes that that is the way to do it, to actually take you to the energy of the site, connect with the energy of the site, and see exactly what's there. We likened it that he teaches by the way of like peeling away the layers of an onion. Like he'll peel away the Islamic layer, which of course is the top. Then he'll peel away the Roman layer, peel away the Christian layer, peel away the Jewish layer, peel away the Greek layer, and then peel away the dynastic layer, which everyone thinks was the civilization. And then he says, what's underneath? He shows it was a series of layers, just like archaeologists work in stratigraphy, going from one layer to another, that a lot of these structures that we look at, which are virtually in ruins, mm-hmm. were really much, much older. And then they just kept coming along and adding maybe inscriptions here, maybe a pylon here, maybe building on top of it. So what we are discovering when we go to these sites, and many people who have been to Egypt will go to sites like the Temple of Luxor, like the Temple of Horus at Edfu, like the Temple of Hathor at Dendera. And what we are looking at, the temple that's there, is the latest temple that's standing, perhaps maybe built by the Greeks when they were there, or by the so-called dynastic peoples. But if you dig underneath, you will find there's an older temple underneath, and maybe an even older temple underneath that. This is where we are in absolute agreement with the academic Egyptologist. Dr. Zahi Hawass, the Director General of the Giza Plateau, makes a statement that we have only excavated maybe less than 20% of what is really there. We would agree and say maybe it's only 10%. Mm-hmm. So there's so much under the sand, yet to be revealed.
But you have a problem when you have this dazzling layer on top. You can't disturb it. You can't knock it down. You can't remove it to go scrape away and see what's below it.
Right.
You have the same thing in Mexico where you have layer upon layer upon layer of these temples, maybe five layers, and we just are dazzled by the outer edge.
Exactly. And some sites around the world, there's a very famous site in Palestine, Jericho, where they claim they've never found what they call archaeological ground zero yet, that they keep digging and digging, find older things underneath. An example I can give you, when I was in Egypt in November of 1992, I was with another tour guide, not with Hakim, but who was also one who was very supportive of this type of work, and we were at the Temple of Luxor. And he said that recently, that was in 92, they had done some excavation work and found the top of a column underneath present temple, and they immediately covered it back up and didn't make it public. They had found the older temple underneath. So what we have discovered in the last couple of years of going out in the field is that some of these things are already partially excavated. We can look. We don't have to do the digging. We will not be given a permit because of situations, political reasons right now. But we can actually look at sites that have been excavated, partially excavated, and see the layers. See what's underneath. And what we have seen now on these sites in the last couple of years is definitely things under the bedrock, underneath the temples, the so-called pyramids that are there. There are structures underneath. It is all well known now, because of all the publicity that's been going on the Giza Plateau, that it is literally pockmarked with tunnels. You've had many guests on, from John West, from Boris Said, who've talked about these things. I have personally investigated and gone in some of the tunnels under the Giza Plateau.
Well, what do they look like?
They're incredible. Well, we downloaded...
Are they square? Are they round? Are they smooth? Are they rough? What are they made of? Are they made of sandstone? Are they lined?
Okay.
Are they filled with water? You know, we have a lot of questions.
All of those things. First of all, it's limestone bedrock, okay? It's the original deposition that was laid down millions of years ago when the ocean came in and laid down all this bedrock. That's what the Giza Plateau is all on, a limestone bedrock. That supposedly the limestone itself dates back 70 million years when it was deposited.
Mm-hmm.
What we see there is tunnels that are drilled at right angles, like rectangles, and they curve and they smooth. The walls are relatively smooth.
So they don't turn a curve, they turn a right angle.
Well, some turn at right angles, some actually curve, and we'll lead into this later, why I think they were built that way, more to be like a natural water course, which doesn't go exactly in straight lines. But yes, they are built at relatively contoured angles, which, of course, if they're going to try to intimate to us that this was done with copper chisels by hand, I would really like to see somebody who could go into limestone bedrock. We say these tunnels are at least miles and miles long. We cannot give even an estimate to you now how long some of these tunnels are, but I can give you a story.
Mm-hmm.
But
go ahead, give me a story.
Okay. Hakim tells a story when he was about 17 years old. He used to go around all the sites. He was at Saqqara. Now, if people know where Saqqara is approximately 10 miles from Giza. He went into a tunnel at Saqqara, and he walked, and he walked, and he walked, and hours later, he came up on the Giza Plateau. So that's 10 miles, at least, of tunnel.
So, when did he do this, and can he do this again? Does he remember
no,
where that opening
fact,
is?
No, he took us back to that exact tunnel, and there's a concrete slab over it. So somebody doesn't want you to go in there. Some of the tunnels I went into the Giza Plateau have limestone rocks blocking the entrances.
Somebody knows about them and how important they are, you're suggesting.
Well, I can tell you that the stories go at least back to the 1920s to an American Egyptologist named George Reisner, who was working at a Boston University, who was one of the most famous Egyptologists. He was working in the Giza tunnels in the 20s and 30s. So they know, at least the Western world knows about him. It sees that long. But the people in the village of Nazlat Esiman, where Hakim lives, have known about him for hundreds of years. So these tunnels are not new things. Dr. Huas has announced that he discovered a tunnel in the back of the Sphinx, the Rump, in 1987. That's utter nonsense, because I know the man who found that tunnel in the 30s and told about it to Dr. George Reisner.
Mm-hmm.
So the interesting thing is these tunnels go very far, they go at all different angles, and they all seem to end in water. The key thing that Hakim has been hammering to me over these last couple of years is water. he thinks a key to what we're looking at, what the civilization was designed on, what a lot of these structures were built for, has to do with water.
Hydraulics.
He uses the commission term afgat, which means water.
We'll continue. After all, water is the source of life, right? It's so fitting. We'll continue with Stephen Mailer learning more about these tunnels that seem to riddle the Giza Plateau and elsewhere. It's not just the Giza Plateau. Many, many sites, he says, contribute to this picture of indigenous wisdom now about to be revealed. So this is the Lorelei Show. Lorelei here on The Lorelei Show as we continue with Stephen Mailer of the Kinnaman Foundation and working with Hakim in Egypt. Boy, you saw and you heard and you learned a lot of interesting things, Stephen. Thanks for sharing a bit more about those tunnels just so we can picture them in our minds.
Yes, well, I went into one tunnel which is actually, I don't know if you're going to be able to get that up on the website, but it is an image I downloaded to you.
Uh-huh.
It's an area called the Temple of the Four Guardians, which is near the second pyramid, the middle pyramid. On the Giza Plateau. I went down an area about 30 feet down, and there it was blocked by somebody put boulders there to block an entrance. Well, I was able to force an entrance, put a flashlight in, and put my camera down and take a picture down the tunnel.
Okay.
What that tunnel clearly shows is, incredible, right through the limestone bedrock, at right angles, relatively smooth walls, and it seems to end in a dead end, but it makes a distinct turn to the left where also it's blocked by some rocks. Well, that left-hand turn leads directly to the Sphinx. So we know all the controversy, what everybody's talking about is halls of records and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when we discussed this subject with Hakim in 1997, he said, you want to see the halls of records? I'll show you where the tunnels are, but bring your scuba diving equipment because they all end in water. And indeed, we know this for a fact. As I mentioned about Dr. Reisner, his son actually drowned in one of these tunnels, and this is in all seriousness, in 1938. Was he looking for the halls of records, or was he just investigating? We don't know, but indeed, he did drown. So this is a serious story. We know for years, at least since the 60s, but very more so in the 70s and 80s, the Supreme Council of Antiquities has been pumping water out. Continually, we saw the pumps when we were there. They're continually trying to pump water out of these tunnels so they can go in and investigate. So they all end in water. Some of these tunnels actually showed us go down 300 meters. The water is down 1,000 feet down. That's how far down the tunnels go, and they end in water. So what Hakim's teachings basically are is all these sites, and we'll talk about the sites that we call Buwizer, all of them have water underneath. There is an underground river that is still
uh-huh.
there. He maintains that this underground river is not the Nile as she is today, but was a much older river that existed, which in today is only the western Libyan desert, west of all of these sites, but was once a mighty and huge river that was the source of the water for the ancient Kemetian civilization.
Now, can you see this ancient river on satellite photos? I understand with certain satellite images and other kinds of images you can take, you can actually see ancient riverbeds.
Well,
Does it show up?
That is great, great point, Laura. We have seen some photographs. That's something I wish we could get funding to investigate. Some NASA photographs that I have seen do show it.
Mm-hmm.
They show this definitely. They show actually more sites that are still under the sand that should be excavated. You know, the great story a couple of years ago of one of the great cities in Saudi Arabia, one of the great sites on the caravans was found.
Mm-hmm.
The source of all the frankincense and incense in the Bible was found by a NASA photograph that showed it underneath the sand.
Hmm.
But what we have found evidence that the river's still there. The interesting thing that I bring out, which I'm going to bring out in my book, is these tunnels coming from the west at a lot of these sites in particular are going in a downhill direction from west to east. So they could not possibly be going to the river where she is today, which is east of all of these sites.
Because water doesn't run uphill.
Water
it runs downhill.
Water seeks its own course.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of it is in a downhill slope.
On the other hand, if you're saying that this was built 10,000 years ago, many of these buildings, these pyramids, then why would they build so far away from the river? The
yeah.
river that was then. If you're
right,
saying
well,
if the river was west of there, some miles, how many miles away?
Oh, yeah, it's a good, right now we'd say the river from a lot of these sites was probably a good 15 to 100 miles.
That far away?
Yeah.
Why would you build so far away from a river?
Because the river still flowed underground. What they did was, we believe what we have seen, and particularly in this last trip I took with him, that the civilization did start out by that river. What we went to, and this last time I was with him, was these four main oases, which are still left in the western desert, called Farafra, Baharia, Karga, and Dakhla. That was one of the main things he wanted to show me this time. What we saw was that we believed that that was where the river was. All that's left now is these huge oases, mm-hmm. which are very green and fertile, which have no rainfall and no irrigation, and yet they're growing everything imaginable.
Then they must have some other water source.
It's the ground table. The ground mm-hmm. table, because the river's still there. So the civilization started there and moved eastward. Now, why did they choose the sites mm-hmm. of Giza, Saqqara, Abusir? Yes, why? He claims because of the energy that's involved there, because of the particular flowing of the water. The river that was above ground also flowed underground to these areas and crisscrossed in different directions.
Was there a Nile there back then, do you think?
Yes.
Okay, so there were two rivers. You're talking about a two-river system.
The argument is when it was, but we know one of the things that set me on this course, there was two things that set me on this course.
Okay.
One, I have to give credit to our colleague and friend, John Anthony West.
Mm-hmm.
When John West was criticized for his theory of redating the Sphinx with Robert Schock, who you've all interviewed, all these people, one of the criticisms from Dr. Mark Lehner was, show me a potsherd, he said. If there was a previous civilization that built the Sphinx, he criticized saying, well, show me a potsherd, show me a cultural context. In other words, show me some other evidence of this other civilization.
Fair question. They just weren't looking in the right place, but
well,
you have been, haven't you? You were saying
yes.
that you've done some core samples, and you found those potsherds.
Right. Well, John West responded by saying, we need to trace perhaps the river where the old Nile was. So John actually gave
Good
me,
point.
And I give him credit for that, he gave me the key.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought about it. Okay.
Trace where the old Nile was.
Trace where mm-hmm. the old Nile was. And indeed, this has been done. There was a German geologist over 100 years ago named G.V. Blankenship who postulated that there was what he called an Ur-Nile, Ur-U-R. Ur is a German word that's used often to mean primordial or ancient. It was a term that Victor Schauberger used very often, and we're eventually going to get to discuss him. So I said, okay, then where is that? Well, they postulated it was, where is the Western Desert today? Geologists know that there was a river there. There's no doubt about it. There's no argumentation here. The argument is, when was the river there? Geologists like to use time periods of millions of years ago, that the ocean came in all through North Africa, carved out incredible landscapes, then receded, then there was a huge river there, which they called the Ur-Nile or the Proto-Nile, and then it dried up and disappeared. Well, our investigation, our argument was, yes, it did, but that was only around 10,000 years ago. Over 10,000 years ago, that area had ample rainfall, was verdant and green and lush, and there was a huge river there. Along around, we say, maybe 11,500 years ago, which a lot of other investigators mm-hmm. who you've had on the show, like Dr. Paul LaViolette, like the geologists Alan and Dallaire in their book Cataclysm 9500 BC, saying some type of major event, earth-wide cataclysm, occurred around 11,500 years ago. Somehow all the climate changed, the shifting of the earth changed, and there no longer was any rainfall to support this river. It dried up, and now we only have the Nile where she is today. She opened, expanded, and that's the Nile. But there is definite geological evidence that there were two Niles over 10,000 years. The Nile, as it is today, was only a thin ribbon, only a very small river. But over 10,000 years ago, perhaps over 15, 20,000 years ago, there was a huge river, which is today only western desert, and the only remains are these four large oases.
How lucky then that you have an area where it just dried up, because of course dryness is such a wonderful preservation means.
Exactly.
The stuff is still there to go find.
Some of the evidence we found last year when we went to
yeah.
sites like Saqqara and Abusir is that we just did a little bit of digging underneath what is topsoil, which is sand, and we found silt.
Now, meaning?
Silt says there was water there. What we also find is evidence of ancient lake beds. And what do we find? We still find vegetation there. You know, there was a wonderful line that Jeff Goldblum and, in the movie Jurassic Park as Dr. Malcolm, and I love that line, where he said, life always finds a way. And it's true. We would go out into the desert and we would find a shoot or a bush, and it was throwing its roots way into the sand, but they knew it knew the water was there. The water is there under the sand. What we see as desert, the Sahara, the Libyan desert, is only topsoil. Obviously, underneath it, it's still silt. There was still fertility. There's still vegetation. This is only recent. Most geologists who have an open mind would agree that the Sahara Desert and Libyan Desert are only recent within the last 8 to 10,000 years.
Prior to that, they were very verdant.
Right.
I like the way Michael Crichton says it in Jurassic Park, life will find a way.
Exactly.
We're going to come right back with Stephen Mailer and learn more about what they recently found and what has long been an indigenous wisdom about the Kemetians, the pre-Egyptian civilization, way, way, way back. This would then be, Stephen, in civilization that was disrupted at some point, or affected at least, by this worldwide cataclysm known to have happened 12,000 years ago at the end of the last ice age.
It went dormant, let's say.
I'm sorry?
It went dormant.
Went dormant.
But Hakim doesn't see that there was a break. He sees that it was continuous, but certainly this cataclysm ended a lot of the use of the pyramids for their original intention, which we will discuss. And there was a period of a couple thousand years where it had to recover. And what the recovery was is what the Egyptologists called dynastic Egypt.
A little more on that when we come back just after this. You're listening to The Laura Lee Show. I'm Laura Lee. Laura Lee here on The Laura Lee Show. We continue with Stephen Mailer of the Kinnaman Foundation. You know, Stephen, it is time for all indigenous civilizations, the cultures everywhere to stand up and be counted and be recognized. This is so exciting.
Yes.
I'd love to find more out about the indigenous population of, you know, our own Caucasians, you know, my own.
Right.
You know, a lot of that was so lost and it's so fragmented, but if you know where to look, you can find it again. So the indigenous Egyptians, that's very exciting. We talked about a prototype Stonehenge at Nabta in Egypt. Does this fit into that anywhere?
Well, interestingly enough, Hakim does not give much credence to that. He doesn't think that that's a very important site. What they're indicating there is that's about 6,000 to 8,000 years ago, and it was a solstitial marker or things like that. But, you know, basically we're saying that pyramids and the so-called temples of Kemet are older than that. So that wouldn't have been, we don't think that's an important site.
Hey, there's ups and there's downs, and there's lost, and then there's a regaining and a renaissance, and so.
Exactly.
Yeah. So tell me about some of the sites that you saw, and I believe we have that map up on our website. We built a page for you.
Oh, great.
So you can check out the map. It's called Bulwizer.
Bulwizer.
W-Z-R. You'll have to explain that term, but I just want to give people an address to go to so they can take a look at that page that we put up for you. And that address is www.lauralee.com, spelled L-A-U-R-A-L-E-E. And thanks to GB and Paul for getting that up. And thank you, Stephen, for sending your images.
You're welcome.
Let's begin.
What the map shows.
Oh, Bulwizer. You have to explain that term.
Yes, Bulwizer. That is a term that Hakim told to my partner Bob Vauder when he was in Egypt in 96. He had not ever mentioned that to us before. Bul means land in the Kemetian language. Wizer is the correct term for what the Greeks called Osiris. Now, who was Osiris? That could be a whole different discussion. But for essential sake, Osiris was one of those so-called created gods, created deities, so-called perhaps mythological figure that the ancient Kemetians much venerated. Now, according to their own mythology and traditions, Osiris Wizer was an individual who came and was a very kind and benevolent king and leader, and led the people out of so-called barbarism, out of savagery, and taught them science, law, religion, engineering, mathematics, and agriculture, and became...
Fine, but where did Osiris learn all that?
That's the source of the mythology. Where did he come from? I mean, that could lead to a whole other discussion, because there's those...
Oh, we'll have that next week, but go ahead.
Who believes that he was an extraterrestrial, say, or he saw something like that, or an Atlantean.
Does Hakim teach that?
No, he doesn't support that. He does talk about possible landings many, many, many hundreds of thousands of years ago. So he's not against the fact that, like Zechariah, he knows Zechariah Sitchin. He does support some of Zachariah Sitchin's theories. He knows about Lloyd Pye and Alan Alford and other people you've had on who say these things. And he does take you to certain... There's one site in particular that we actually take people to called Abu Ghurab, which he says clearly was a landing site. So he does believe that. But when it comes to Whizzer, he believes he was a commission. But he was a commission who was just a highly evolved individual and has become a myth. But the idea that we're bringing about the whole concept of Boo Whizzer is this was the area that Whizzer Osiris settled first, where he had the people become a stable civilization with agriculture, with engineering, building temples, building pyramids. And so these are the most ancient sacred sites in this area. And they are from the south to the north, because that's how the river has flowed and always flows from the south to the north. It starts from Dashur, a very site that a lot of people know about. There's two very well-known pyramids there, to Saqqara, to Abu Sir and Abu Ghurab, two very interesting sites, to an area called Zawiyat El Aryan, which is not well-known and visited, to Giza, the most famous site we all know about, to a site in the north called Abu Ruwash, which in some ways is the most amazing of all the sites, and hardly anyone ever goes to Abu Ruwash.
Well, it's off the beaten track, isn't it?
Yes. Well, there's really nothing there. There was supposed to be a pyramid there. It's only virtually in ruins, or the Egyptologists claim it was never completed. There's no tourists there. There's no antiquity police. There's no bakshish, nothing. So you can go there. There's nobody there to bother you. And so we had a wonderful time investigating there because there's no one there.
Is this the place where the pyramids in the mountain? I've got to hear more about that.
Yes.
That's it.
It's fascinating. We can peek each site individually, but I don't know if we have enough time to do that. But Abu Ruwash is the most amazing to me, and this is why Hakim saved it, actually, for last. It's a site. Now, I'll give you the standard story that the Egyptologists tell.
Okay.
In academic Egyptology, it supposedly was a site chosen by the third son of the king who they use the name Khufu Cheops, who everyone believes in Egyptology built the Great Pyramid as his tomb. He had a couple of sons. His third son has gone by different names. We use the name Djedjetfra. He supposedly left the site of Giza, did not want to build, now this is the standard story, did not want to build his pyramid there, chose the site of Abu Ruwash. Why? No, there's never given a reason, but he chose this site to have his pyramid built there. But for some reason, he did not use the technology that his father's architects had designed. He did not use the science. He decided to build a pyramid according to the old style, the so-called Third Dynasty style, mostly of mud brick with a little bit of limestone, and it never was completed, or it collapsed, or there's really no evidence of it. Now, the only evidence they have linking this supposed king, Djedjetfra, to this site is about a quarter of a mile from the site. 100 years ago, in the 1890s, they found a piece of granite of a bust of a statue that had a cartouche on it, supposedly was Djedjetfra, and therefore then the Egyptologists make the conclusion that he built that pyramid. There's nothing else to attribute it to.
I guess they had not much else to go on, huh?
No. What the site is amazing. It is a small mountain that comes out of the valley. It goes about 2,000 feet high. And what is evident when one investigates this site, and I must admit that I myself was guilty of accepting the standard academic Egyptological view until I went there myself, that it was this Djedjetfra, it was a pyramid that was poorly built, and there's nothing left there. No, not at all. What I have observed, and I have photographic evidence of, which will be in my book, and which is on you can post, is that what they did is they cored. The mountain is limestone.
It's
part of the limestone bedrock that's rising up 2,000 feet. They, the commissions, whoever built it, cored the mountain out, tunneled it out, and built the infrastructure of this pyramid in the mountain. And it rose up out of the mountain. What we definitely saw was limestone and granite, not mud brick, that it was built the same way the Great Pyramid was built, same way the other pyramids of all the Bouwizer sites were built, with limestone, with basalt, with granite, with the so-called igneous rock, and that they actually laid the core infrastructure of this pyramid into the mountain. How they did that, has to come up with a whole other design of technology than we're told from the academic Egyptologists.
I got a question, though. You've got a mountain that looks rather pyramidal in its basic shape, and then you're going to build another pyramid inside the mountain. So what are you ending up with, like a double-shelled pyramid?
Almost that. You've got a mountain rising up, and then you're going to have probably two-thirds of the pyramid rising up out of the mountain. So you're right. What it's definitely was a wonderful view from on top of that mountain. The pyramid is nothing left of it. This is why the Supreme Council of Antiquities has done no excavation work there since the 1890s, and virtually there's nothing there. Nobody goes there. All that's left is part of the core infrastructure. For some reason, either the pyramid was quarried or it was destroyed. We don't agree that it was not completed. It obviously looks like it was completed, but something happened there that it's no longer there. This can lead to a lot of speculations, maybe a destruction, maybe a war, or something else. But
are there other buildings so that they would have said, oh, look, here's a nice quarry, let's just take some of these stones. Is there something else built around?
No.
So if it was quarried, would it have hauled the stones
long way? If it was quarried in the same place the Great Pyramid was quarried, it was quarried in the Mokattam Hills, which is 8 miles east of Cairo. So it had to have been quarried a good 15 to 20 miles away.
I thought by quarried you meant that somebody came through and started using those stones into that pyramid as a quarry.
That's right. I'm talking about the original quarrying to build it. You're correct. Yeah. If it was quarried, then we say that what happened to the Great Pyramid, the Arabs or some other group came in, attacked the pyramid, and pulled down the stones to...
Build their own buildings, yeah.
Yeah, but to me, it doesn't make any sense why anybody would have quarried. They'd have to climb up to 2,000 feet, attack this pyramid, pull all these stones and haul them. And we're talking not just limestone, but granite.
Then you should be able to find the stones and rubble around where they used to be all nicely put into a pyramid, right?
Right.
And do you?
No. All we do is find all that's left there now is the mountain.
Yeah.
Obviously, the tunneling, the coring is there. It's easy to go. You easily can climb in there, which I did. Took photographs to see where it's cored out and to see where the infrastructure is still there, laid in.
But how are you so sure that there was once a completed building if you can't find any remains of it?
That's the tradition. Now, you're right there to make a skeptical point, but that's part of what the teaching, the commission teachings is. That there was a pyramid.
Then you're left with the aliens came down and zapped them away, you know,
possibly.
Stones away.
Well, you know, people can speculate that way, but one thing is for sure is there was a huge structure there, and it was not mud brick, because we found the granite, and we find the limestone, and we find this incredible. This is going to lead us to, you know, another discussion, if you want to continue, to why the pyramids were built and what they were used for.
Let's
but obviously
that next with Stephen Mailer and talk more. By the way, we'd like to also ask you, not enough time until we come back. Lots to discuss about his recent adventures and recent finds from Egypt. His teacher, Hakim, a member of the indigenous wisdom tradition, still alive. It's so gratifying, Stephen, to understand that very ancient 60,000-year-old culture would still be alive and well today and able to talk with us. You will continue with Stephen Mailer of the Kinnaman Foundation right here on The Laura Lee Show. I'm Laura Lee. We continue this hour with Stephen Mailer of the Kinnaman Foundation. He's been regaling us with some new sites in Egypt to consider. He says there's an indigenous population there, an indigenous culture that goes back, that can trace their lineage back 60,000 years. That's a long time. So through a few cataclysms. And he says Hakim, his own teacher, Hakim is a member of that brotherhood which keeps alive this indigenous wisdom. By the way, it's a matrilineal kind of thing that I think is a hallmark of those indigenous cultures. And for the last hour, Stephen has been telling us a little bit of background about this culture and what they left behind. And you say, and you have a map that you sent us, and we have on our website at loralee.com, www.loralee.com. Thank you, Stephen, for that. That there's a lot of sites that just are off the beaten path of the regular tourists that go to Egypt. These are very important sites, Hakim says, remnants of this Kemetian culture, Kemet being the original term for Egypt, Kemetians thus being the term for the indigenous population of Egypt. This is pre- the Egypt that we know. And you say the Egypt that we see when we go there is the latest dynasty and some of the few later dynasties. This is just the latest layer of a many-layered cake. You're also getting into a little bit about pyramid and building. I suppose then that at Abydos, wouldn't the Osirian, you mentioned Bowizer, the land of Osiris, Wizer being one of the early terms for Cyrus, so Cyrus always being a very important character as it was clear through the Egyptian culture as a creator god, perhaps as a actual historical figure and certainly a legendary figure, deep into their cosmology, he figures. So would the Osirian in Abydos be also, because of its huge megalithic and beautiful architecture that is so different from the later Egyptian architecture? Paul, do we have Stephen up?
Consider the Osirian to be part of Bowizer, but we certainly would consider the Osirian to be part of the ancient Kemetian civilization, which goes back over 10,000 years. This has been pointed out, of course, by John Anthony West, by Drunville of Melchizedek, by others, because of its particular architectural style. And in fact, clearly, if one goes to Abydos and looks at the temple supposedly of Seti I and Ramses II that is in front, and you go to the Osirian, it's a good 50 feet lower than the temple that's there that everybody goes to. So obviously it's from an earlier archaeological site period. It has to be dated earlier. And even you talk to the indigenous people that are there at Abydos, and they will say the Osirian is much, much older. But it's not exact. What we call the Bouwizer sites are the sites that we elucidated of Dashur, Saqqara, Abusir, Abu Ghraib, Zariat el-Erian, Giza, and Abu Dawash. That's what makes up the Bouwizer sites.
The ones that you know of, anyway.
Yes, you're right.
Because if you're right, you go 100 miles to the west and you're going to find a bunch more, right?
Yeah, well, we find the civilization started perhaps way out in the west and then moved eastward.
Just to recap, if you haven't heard the last hour, Stephen was saying that there used to be a much larger Nile, since dried up, about 100 miles to the west, and many of the tunnels he was talking about under Giza, under Saqqara, under some of these other sites, go west, and they elevate so that water once came from a western Nile and flowed down into these sites. Major hydraulic system that's part of your body of evidence. But go ahead now.
Right, that's exactly right. And, of course, this will lead to the theories of why the pyramids were built and what they were used for. And we come to our wonderful good friend and colleague, Christopher Dunn, who you've had on. And I briefly just want to mention and give you the credit, Laura, and the thanks for a series of synchronistic events that have brought Christopher Dunn and myself together.
Oh, really?
We both appeared on your show 2 years ago. This is November 1996. You interviewed Chris first and then myself. He had an article out then about ancient machining in ancient Egypt, and you brought him on. We did not know each other, totally unknown to each other. I had read his article. I knew of his work, but he did not know of mine. So that started a ball rolling. About a month or two later, we had articles appearing in the same issue of Atlantis Rising.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that, we were both invited to be on a cable access TV show in Santa Barbara, California, in February of 1997. There we got to meet. It was an instant connection, instant friendship. We've become excellent close friends and colleagues since then.
Well, my level of synchronicity is Paul and I went to Egypt with John Anthony West in October of 96, and we started seeing machine tool marks all over the place. We didn't even have that kind of training, and it was so obvious.
Oh, that's great.
Spend a day in the Cairo Museum and really look at those sarcophagi lids, some of them, and you can see this. Look at those beautiful stone bowls. So I've been hearing about Chris, so immediately I'm going to the guy that could tell me about those machine tool marks. And it just happened that you were and he were on the same night
on
the show.
Well, that's cosmic synchronicity, because...
Sure.
Then Chris and I became friends. He began to share some of his manuscript with me. I made comments upon it. My research partner, Bob Vodder, who is responsible for the map that you put on the website, he made that map up, computer generated. And he is also a musician, an acoustical engineer. So his background really leads to some of the work that Tom Danley has done. We can discuss it another time.
Oh, we've had Tom on the show about acoustics and the King's Chamber.
Exactly. Bob has done a lot of... Bob is doing is mapping the frequency. We believe every pyramid is tuned to a different acoustical frequency, and Bob is actually mapping the mathematics of that. Well, We got friends with Chris. Chris gave me some of his manuscript. I was fortunate and blessed and honored to be able to review a pre-publication copy of the Giza Power Plant in May of this year. It is my comment that appears on the back of the book. I'm honored to be in the book. So Chris and I have become great friends and colleagues. So what we're doing now is trying to flesh out. You had Chris on. People, your listeners who remember Chris, they've heard Chris's show. He is not concerned with the who and the when. Chris is concerned, because of his background, the how and the why. He looked at the Great Pyramid and distinguished and extensive holistic research for over 20 years from his background as an engineer, as a master craftsman, as a machinist, to see that the way it's built and how it's built must have been built by people who had sophisticated knowledge and advanced machining to use the machines, the tools, and the materials that were used. So what Hakim has done is fleshing out for us from the indigenous tradition is the when and the who. The who is the Kamishans. We're not going to stand here and say extraterrestrials. We're not going to say Atlanteans. We're going to say the people, the Kamishan people, had the ability to build that structure exactly the way Chris Dunn says, and for the reasons Chris Dunn says.
I believe that. Why give all the credits if you can find humans? We're right here. We're pretty bright people.
Well, we can explain the why. Because,
okay.
Again, just quickly, I would
the
like...
The detective story isn't the who, when, where, why.
Right. I'd like to just give a little bit of Kamishan teaching that will be in Hakim's book, which will be released. Hakim and his wonderful consort and co-teaching partner named Corina Bryan, who lives in Alameda, California, have written this manuscript together, which we hope will be published by Baron Company in the spring. It is called Egypt and the Awakening, Insights of an Egyptian Adept. In there, he gives a basic framework of Kemetology, the ancient indigenous teachings, which I am going to elaborate upon in my book.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just simply for now, so people have an understanding, there's three, actually four, but three terms we need to discuss.
Okay.
The term per means house, house of, in the Kamishan language. The term per ka, again, we discussed ka earlier. For those who weren't with us, it means a physical projection of the soul. It's the personality. The per ka is what became, in our language, the tomb. That's where you placed the body. Per ba, ba is the word which many people have written about, which means the soul or the spirit. So per ba, the house of the soul or spirit, became the temple in the Hebrew language, and it's the word we use today for temple, the place where the soul is elevated, where consciousness is raised, where one prays. The term that's key for our understanding is the term per neter, the house of the neter. Neter, translated by A.E. Wallace Budge, the keeper of the British Museum in the 1880s, he translated it as God or goddess because he didn't know how else to see it. How he saw it in a context that he was translating, it had something he thought to do with deity. So it becomes the word for God or goddess. Well, Hakim teaches us the word neter became the Greek word nature. House of nature. You could still say house of God, but house of nature. That is the pyramid. And so we clearly indicate to people, differing from the Egyptologists, that no one was ever intended originally to be buried in a per neter or a per ba, in a temple or in a pyramid, only in the tomb, which is the per ka. And the per ka was something that was dug in the ground or in the sides of mountains. We go to the Valley of the Kings today, we see where all the supposed pharaohs, they were carved tombs, elaborate tombs, tunneling into mountains. Why would they take these structures, pyramids, to go through all that expense to put a body in there? Chris Dunn looked at that and he said, it doesn't make sense. There had to be another reason why those structures were built. And indeed, as a house of nature, what it's intended to be is a structure for the utilization, creation, and communication of energy, of natural source of.
And let's talk more about that. But a lot of people, Stephen, have been saying there were no burials in the pyramids. They didn't
even
find
Mark
bodies.
Lehner himself, in his latest book called The Complete Pyramids, even the great Egyptologist, supposedly the champion of the other side of us, has said that in the 72 pyramids that exist in Egypt, there has never been a trace of an original burial in any one of them, including the Great Pyramid.
So can we... can we conclude that these just weren't built to be tombs?
No.
The tombs look very different. There's lots of tombs in Egypt. They look very different.
Yes.
We'll come back with more from Stephen Mailer. You're listening to The Laura Lee Show. I'm Laura Lee. here on The Laura Lee Show as we continue with Stephen Mailer of the Kinnaman Foundation, telling us about some of the new finds, new theories about Egypt and an indigenous population going back 60,000 years. So when we look at the Great Pyramid and we look at the temple or the pyramid at Saqqara and some of these other sites, Stephen, you're saying, how old are they?
Well, they vary. Again, it's different layers and layers and layers, but we're looking, I'm giving a starting point now. You know, some people have real problems with these dates when we start going back. They get real nervous, but at least over 10,000 years. That's what we're saying.
What's the evidence? Besides Hakim saying that this is so, you must want to say,
well, it appears to me the river, the water. If indeed they are bringing the water to these sites from the Nile where she used to be, we know for a fact that the desert conditions are about 8,000 to 10,000 years old. So we'll give you a starting point that if indeed it was all, we not only do we believe that they were using underground tunnels to bring the water, we find evidences that there, all these sites, were, that the Giza Plateau was surrounded by water. In fact, Hakim teaches, and we're convinced of, that this Sphinx, in its hollow, was on its her own lake, that there was a lake around it with trees and verdant, and so the water was there in evidence. There was enough rainfall, which John West and Robert Schock have said, to cause the damage. So at least 10,000 years ago, these sites were built. I believe the Great Pyramid was built in three distinct stages, at least 10 to 20,000 years ago.
Let's get to the stages of the pyramid, but first, you said that first there were two Niles, that there was the current Nile somewhere around in that same vicinity, and then there was this other Nile. There's two rivers, so let's give them two names. What does Hakim call this?
Well, we can call the old Nile the Ur-Nile, as some of the Germans like, or the Proto-Nile, which means previous.
It was very much agreed upon that there was a great river above ground, and now it's really flowing below ground.
Yes.
And geologists will tell you that there's a lot of water flowing through the bedrock and such under the surface, won't they?
Yes.
So.
Yes, exactly. And what we found when we went out into the desert this time and examined the oases, which are very green and lush, is that they have no rainfall, there's no irrigation, and yet they're growing everything imaginable for every type of fruit, vegetable, and grain only from the groundwater, so that the river's still underground. It just dried up on the surface because there wasn't the rainfall to support it.
Now, why would they build extensive tunnels if there already was the current Nile there?
Well, what appears to us is what we examined is that the civilization may have started in its rudimentary form right by the river, which, of course, is a fact of human history. We usually start our civilizations where there's a river for transportation, for agriculture, for growing, of course, where the silt is, where you can grow everything. And they moved eastward. Why did they move eastward? Well, again, it has to do with the knowledge that these people had. They chose these specific sites of Giza, of Abu Ruwash, of Dashur Saqqara, because of the energy that was involved there, because maybe, again, Wizard Osiris told them these were sites to build. And they built structures to bring the water in, just like we do today. Why, we have a city, Phoenix, we have a city, Los Angeles. There's no natural water supplies for these areas. We have built water courses, or aqueducts, channels to bring water from a natural source.
But don't you think it's weird that they would go to all this trouble? I mean, that's extensive, a lot of trouble to go through, to bring water there, and then a Nile shows up there, you know, 10,000 years later?
Well, what they did was...
I mean, what are the chances of that? Unless the Nile was already there.
The Nile was already there in the west.
Right.
They actually went eastward and they brought the Nile with them. They made channels and aqueducts, so they created lakes. They created an artificial river system so that they could just flow their boats from where the old Nile was in the west and flow to these sites 10, 20, 30, 50 miles away.
Well, how did a huge river like the Nile end up there today? So what I'm saying is, you go to all this trouble to make a Nile, and then a real Nile shows up a few thousand years later?
Well, then again, we have what happened maybe 11,500 years ago. Was there a cataclysmic event which totally shifted the geology and the meteorology of this area and caused the river as she is today to get much larger, to carve out the valley as she is today, which became later the dynastic civilization? But originally that was a very small river.
Mm-hmm.
So something points to a great change geophysically about 11,500 years ago, which a lot of other authors have really been arguing for lately.
Oh, I think it's... Hasn't geology accepted it yet? There's such an abundance of evidence. I mean, you have an ice age end, and you don't think the climate's going to change?
Right.
Come on.
Well,
what do we think we know about climatology these days?
Right.
An ice age ended. That is a shift in climate, for heaven's sakes.
Right.
So I think that's... And they're finding evidence for huge melting glacier lakes and all of this that carve out. Right here in Seattle, Washington, you go east a little bit, and you've got this huge floodplain that they talk about, end of the last ice age. I mean, they know these things happen. Maybe they haven't put it together with what effect there were on civilizations.
Exactly. Nobody seems to be... They're not approaching it holistically. I mean, you do have two geologists like Allen and Dallaire who've written a book. They are geologists, and they say the geological evidence is overwhelming. You get a physicist like Paul LaViolette who's saying the evidence is overwhelming. I mean, tremendous people are...
But nobody's connecting it to civilization
because
they weren't supposed to start until 8,000 years ago, not 11,000 years ago. And then you find Sumer, you know, three-foot mud flows. Oh, please. And you don't think that's connected?
Right.
You're listening to The Laura Lee Show. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online, www.lauralee.com.